Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Well, the ASX is hovering around record highs. Investors have received quite a lovely suite of dividends post-reporting season, touched down on last year, but nothing to complain about. And generally, everyone's got good reason to be feeling positive about their portfolios. But NAB Trades investors are not buying en masse at the moment. There's a real sense of wanting to stay on the sidelines. It seems quite clear that investors are reluctant to really get into this market. But is it time to sit back, or is there much more going on than you might imagine? Today, I'm joined by Gaurav Sodhi, the Deputy Head of Research and Intelligence Investor, to discuss what's going on in markets and what investors should be looking out for. We've had Gaurav on before. He's wonderful. We're excited to have you back. Gaurav, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Gemma. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is such an interesting time in markets. It's always an interesting time, but I find these periods when it's very high, but it's kind of flattening out. There's not a lot of energy behind the ASX at the moment. Been quite a grind getting to where we are. Mm. How are you feeling as an investor right now? I know that's an odd question, but what does this feel like to you?
It's really important to know or have some idea about where you are in the cycle. At Intelligent Investor, we don't think too much about the macro, and we're not trying to time markets. We're really focused on businesses. But overlaying that is an awareness about the cycle and where you sit in it. And it's important because it determines a lot of your investing behaviors. And you can recognize where you are in the cycle by looking around you. I mean, not always right, but we have some idea. I reckon, Gemma, and this is probably a controversial assessment, I reckon we're at the cusp of a new bull market. I'm extremely bullish about the market in general. And that's not to say I'm running out and buying every stock, but if you're sitting on the sidelines in cash, I think you're making a mistake. I think the signs are looking really, really good for the market. I like the fact that there's so much caution out there. I like that there's so much worry. The reluctance to invest, I've seen it too, and it's coming out in your numbers. All positive signs. Institutions are behaving just as warily as retail investors. And this is exactly what you see at the beginning of a bull market. You see poor macroeconomic indicators. Remember, the market's looking 12 to 18 months ahead. So the indicators coming out now, which reflect what was happening in the economy in the past, are all going to be terrible. But the market's looking ahead. So you're going to see bull markets are born when the macro indicators look bad and when the behavior of investors is cautious. You're seeing that at the moment. Company results have been okay. I actually thought the reporting season was better than expected. You know, that's a large blanket statement, and there were good in parts of reporting season, but I'm pretty happy with the way businesses have reported. Balance sheets are in good strength. So I'm pretty excited about where markets are actually. And I've been cautious for a few many years, especially during the post-COVID boom. I would say we missed out on a lot of that exuberance and deliberately avoided it. But I think now is the time when cautious, sensible investors can start getting more exposure to the market. And as I said before, if you're sitting around with a big pile of cash thinking that you've got a moat, you are, I think, potentially making the wrong decision and missing out. Now is the time to be fully invested.
That is literally the boldest start to a podcast I think I've had in years. That's so awesome. So you're the first person who has said this in a really long time. Mm. And your reasons for saying it are very different to some of the other conversations we've been having, a lot of the sort of research and commentary that you look at. That is very cool. I imagine there are many people kind of pricking up their ears now going, wow. And also you have such a calm voice. So it's sort of this very calm voice with this very bold statement. But I think it's awesome. That's really exciting because we've not, you know, it's very clear our investors are not thinking that way at the moment. Yeah. So let's talk about how they should be thinking about this. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask these questions at the end, but I know this is kind of your wheelhouse. There is a little rumbling and it's coming from offshore investors. It doesn't appear to be a specifically domestic thing, despite the fact there's a very obvious reason why it would be coming from Australia, which is that we may be at the start of a very significant commodities. Do I use super cycle? Can I say that? Yeah, like commodities are going to take off again, and it's been a while, and this is really coming for us. Do you have a view on that?
I can understand that reasoning. Over the last, I would say, 10 years or so, we've had very little fresh investment into new supply. You can just look at the behavior of the big miners. Look at BHP and Rio Tinto. Most investors would classify them as high-quality businesses, a lot of income funds and buying them. Their dividends have been stupendous. In fact, BHP has been the largest dividend payer in the world over the last few years at least, and probably longer than that. And that's all wonderful for current investors, but what it does suggest is that they're not spending a lot on capital expenditure, exploration, and development. What's true of the big guys has been true across the cycle. So if we look at oil and gas, for example, about $1 trillion worth of capital expenditure, that's $1 trillion over the last 10 years, has not been spent. That was planned to be spent. And that's going to have an impact on energy prices. It's probably already having an impact on energy prices. And that's true across the commodity suite. So there has been a lack of investment. And I think that lack of investment will drive commodity prices higher over time. But I am very cautious about some of these really sexy commodities. That fact that commodity price investment has lagged is not true for lithium and battery metals. And they've experienced a boom and a bust cycle of their own. And the CapEx cycle has moved differently compared to other commodities. So yes, I think there is good reasons to be bullish about commodities over the next 5-10 years, but we need to be selective in those commodities. Iron ore, for example, has had a lot of CapEx put into it. There's a wall of iron ore coming, and probably more cautious about iron ore prices. Lithium, there's been a whole bunch of investment in new supply. Copper is the one commodity that has attracted a lot of capital expenditure. A lot of that hasn't resulted in new supply yet, but the industry is attracting a lot of capital. And for those following the nickel industry, they'd be aware that nickel has been thoroughly disrupted by new technology out of Indonesia and China that has fundamentally changed the supply of nickel. And I think that's a permanent state of affairs. And I don't think we'll see nickel prices at highs ever again. So you have to be selective. I think the point is well made that, yes, there is room here. There are conditions are ripe for a commodities boom. But we can't ignore the bottom up, and we need to be selective about the commodities we choose to invest in, and even more selective after that about the miners we choose to invest in as well.
Yeah, that's such an important point. A lot of our investors, I could say most perhaps of our investors had some exposure to lithium. I wouldn't even say battery metals. Really, it was all lithium. It was good times for everybody. Everyone was having a great time. And then, you know, names that were sort of top 10 2 years ago are nowhere to be seen now. It's all kind of drifted away.
Look, I'm gonna boast a little bit and say that we called it a bubble. I think we were the only people to call it a bubble in public, and was, you know, copped a lot of flack for it. And was happy to sit there and look like a fool while it was all inflating away. But then when it did blow up, we did go in and buy Pilbara. So we in the Intelligent Investor Funds, we do own Pilbara Minerals now. I think that's one of the best lithium miners around. And we've held Mineral Resources for a long, long time, not as a lithium business, but as a wonderful mining business. So you can be negative a commodity for a long time, and it's important to be flexible and change your mind once the conditions for that commodity change. Lithium has been an example of that.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. There are sectors and companies where the structural challenges don't necessarily change. And if they go into decline, they go into decline. But commodities can be very interesting, right? The headwinds suddenly become tailwinds and vice versa. And you want to be willing to, you know, if that's where you play, you've got to be willing to move around.
I love commodities because uniquely, commodities offer so much room for inefficient pricing and mispricing, more so than industrial stocks, just because they're so cyclical. And higher prices attract more capital, which then leads to lower prices, which extracts capital. It's just such a predictable cycle. And it attracts so much ambition and so much greed that you're bound to have mispricings very, very often. And that is the great joy of commodity prices, is that you get to buy these at incredibly cheap prices, and you get to sell it at ridiculously crazy prices. And all of that exuberance and all that fear, I think, is perfectly captured by lithium's journey over the past few years. And I think we're seeing that repeated now with uranium. I mean, I'm amazed at the bullishness around uranium. And a lot of the uranium bulls, frankly, don't really understand that industry, don't understand the engineering or the mechanics behind extraction. And that's the other thing that characterizes mining businesses. It attracts greedy shareholders who act foolishly. And if you're willing to do the work and willing to be sensible, there's opportunities in these industries. And I think lithium might be one at the moment.
It's such a good comment. And Australia has a long history of
yes, <they do.
laughs> we can go back a couple of centuries of attracting those willing to or enthusiastic to make their fortunes in gold panning or something.
The way a lot of people treat investing is just so different to the way they treat other endeavors. If we were going to go on a tennis court and you're going to play someone you don't know at tennis, like, you could be up against Nadal, you could be up against a rank amateur, but you'd want to know something about or have a thought about the person you're playing against, right? Because in a tennis match, someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. Well, it's exactly the same as investing. Every stock that gets sold gets bought. And if you're buying something, it's because someone's selling it. You got to pay attention to what the other person is doing and what the other person is thinking. And it's not really good enough to have these very simple cases of, prices are going to go high or green energy or energy transition. These buzzwords are not an investment case. And I think people don't pay enough attention to the other side. I mean, there are intelligent people on the other side, and we have to consider why someone is selling before we're buying. And we have to consider why someone's buying if we're selling. And if you have that in mind, I think it forces you to do a lot more work than what typically gets done. And I don't just mean retail investors. I can assure you, apparently intelligent and sophisticated institutions do shockingly small amounts of research when it comes to their investments. I've seen some amazing things where, billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars have moved on a trade on very little other than a feeling or instinct or one or two data points, and not the deep knowledge or deep research that you would expect happens in these big institutions. So, this happens across the board.
I think that's a really interesting point. I'm rereading Fooled by Randomness, which is the kind of book where it's all fascinating. You read it the first time, then you forget everything. You have to go back and reread it.
And it's so badly written as well. He makes some wonderful points in that book.
Yeah, so good. Like, if it's just kind of all over the place and yes. You've got to kind of piece it together yourself. Brilliant read. So what I love most about it is almost every serious finance professional has read some of Nassim Taleb's stuff. Mm-hmm. They've probably read Fooled by Randomness because it came out first. And it is amazing to me how many people kind of forget all the major points in it.
Yeah.
It's, that someone can perform very well for a long time just by sheer chance, right? And he always uses the example of flipping a coin or throwing darts at a dartboard. And let's hope not too many of them are just approaching it that way rather than doing the deep research. But I agree with you entirely about commodities. So fascinating how they exemplify a cycle in a way that a lot of things don't quite so much. You learn about cycles, you think this is very interesting, but surely people aren't this bonkers. Have a look at commodities. It's great. Definitely happens every time.
And it
just depends on where you are in it.
It's the emotions that rule. Everyone starts off, I think most people start off when they make an investment decision in a rational place, and fear and greed inevitably take over. And so the job of the investor a lot of the time is yes, do your analysis and do your work, have an investment case, but it doesn't stop there. The task gets harder after that. After that, it becomes about managing your emotions. And that's something you don't read about, you don't get taught. It's something you have to learn. And before you can learn it, you have to want to learn it. It's not an easy thing at all. And this is not true in investing. This is probably true in every endeavor. Jim, I'm probably sure you've seen it at your work and in other parts of your life, but people who can't manage their emotions and aren't aware of them. And I think that's a recipe for success. In my younger days, I'd say 20 years ago, I used to box. And one of the things I learned there was how to control your fear and your anger. You know, when someone hits you, your first reaction is to get really angry, and you just have to bottle that up and control it. And when someone's coming at you, you know, you're always scared, always. And you also have to bottle that up. And that control applies perfectly in investing. You're going to get greedy and you're going to get fearful. And both times you've got to bottle it up. You've got to control it. The best thing you can do, this is not in life, but in investing and in, I think in some endeavors, is to capture the emotion you feel as you're feeling it and put it deep down inside you and not think about it again. It's a horrible way to live, but unfortunately, it is the only way to invest properly.
Try to channel it appropriately. I have seen more boxing than you would imagine.
Little kids, do you have
yeah, I have little. Well, they're doing it in a professional environment, which is impressive. Complete sidebar, but my son was doing it, and he's a small child, very gentle, has no natural aggression at all compared to my daughter, who's got tons. And but they're in the boxing studio that they go to. The guys pad them all up, put on headgear, and get them in the ring and let them have a go at each other. And the first time he did it, he surprised the hell out of all of us by just going hell for leather. Like, they can't really hurt each other, which is good. Mm. And the kid that he was up against was very enthusiastic about boxing, far more so than my child. And then was completely shocked that someone had come at him. He barely threw a punch for the 1 minute or 2 minute, 2 minutes they were in. Barely threw a punch. He was absolutely terrified. And it was amazing to watch him so shocked. The bit of this story that's amazing and may relate to investing, probably doesn't, but you could maybe do something with it, was this child, little boy, he's a bit older than my son, went away and has gone to every single class for the last, say, 18 months, including some of the adult classes. And he's now just unbelievably proficient. And my guess is this kid was devastated by that first interaction in the ring and went, I'm never going to let that happen to me again. It's so impressive. I'm blown away by this kid. My son, on the other hand, kind of went, that was fun. And that was the end of it. Didn't have the same experience. Maybe he needed a nasty shock too.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like that a lot. I mean, you have to know what you don't know, right, before you can learn. There's a book about How to Learn, I think it's called.
There's one by Josh Waitzkin called The Art of Learning.
The Art of Learning, thank you. Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about as well. Yeah, yeah. And he speaks a little bit in that about how learning is actually a skill. And you probably need to acknowledge ignorance before you're ready to learn something. And that can be hard as an adult. And I think that you see that investing all the time. You see people you know, suddenly becoming commodity bulls, lithium bulls. I think we saw some obscure commodities like graphite, rare earths. A lot of people come out as bulls in these areas without letting go of their ignorance and without being prepared to learn. And so that's probably one of the early lessons I learned. I'm speaking from experience. I've done all of that as well. I've been the fool and jumped into a business without understanding it and thought I was looking at the right things and realized I was looking at the wrong things. So we all do it. And the important thing is to learn from it.
We all have a million mistakes we can reflect on. It's always a bit sad to be thinking too much about those. So I love this though, this idea that we're at the beginning of a bull market. And I think many investors will have to probably reconsider their emotional response to that statement, right? They're probably having an emotional response somewhere along the lines of, that can't be correct. I'm very happy earning 4.5% on my cash. I think I'll sit with that. Thank you very much. So let's say they consider that statement, put away the emotional response of fear, one would imagine, you know, I'm happy getting 4.5 too. I really need to try to pursue more. If that's your thesis, what are the things that are exciting you? What makes you feel, which sectors of the market in particular make you feel like this is when we can really start setting ourselves up?
Yeah, no, look, it's not that easy because there are some parts of the market that are crazy expensive. And I'd highlight the high quality, high growth end of the market as being particularly aggressively priced. By that, I mean things like Prometicus, WiseTech, Xero.
Cochlear. We're putting Cochlear in that category.
Yeah, I'm happy to put Cochlear in there. Reese. I mean, Reese is an amazing business. We've owned it in the past. ARB, I'd throw in there as well. Again, an amazing business, which we bought as a small cap and subsequently sold. These are all very high quality businesses, some of the best businesses on the ASX. And they've been widely acknowledged as such. Their prices are really difficult to justify. Now, with a great quality business, time is on your side. You know, if you pay too much for it, it's not a disaster because it will ultimately grow into that valuation. But you need to think about the opportunity cost. You're holding a high quality business, yes, but you're not making a return on it for a long time until it grows into its valuation. We saw this in Microsoft, I would say in the mid-2000s, when Microsoft share price went nowhere for a decade before the Azure business started taking off. And that was a case where a high quality business grew into its valuation and then took off again with the AI stuff. But I think that's what we risk here with the really high quality stuff. So often at the start of a bull cycle, you'd want to be in the highest quality, best businesses you can find. I'm not sure that's the case right now. REA is another one. I've been looking we've done a lot of work on REA and just can't make sense of the valuation. Ditto all the other stocks I've mentioned. We've done work on all those stocks and it's very hard to make sense of that valuation. So this cycle will be different in that way, because at the start of a bull cycle, you generally want to be in the best stuff. I don't think that's the case now. That's not to say you go down and be in the worst stuff. I think in the last cycle, there was a really big emphasis on growth and revenue growth in particular. And that's left a lot of businesses that have plenty of cash flow and pay plenty of dividends as being probably a little bit unloved. A few areas I'll mention is, I mean, we bought coal miners very, very cheaply. And I think, once again, New Hope and Whitehaven are probably looking interesting again. Businesses like Event Hospitality, which is now called EVT, which runs a ski resort, a bunch of hotels, and a cinema business. They own most of their market cap in property, and they're redeveloping some of that property now. It pays a decent yield, has been completely ignored over the last bull market, and I think businesses like that might do better now. Brickworks is probably another one which hasn't run up very much, has been ignored for being kind of a boring business. Sonic Healthcare, you know, to round out a trifecta, is one that's been ignored since the pandemic. But these are fundamentally strong businesses, if not in that top tier of companies, but their valuations are much more attractive. They've been neglected and maligned by the market. They generate wonderful cash flows, have solid balance sheets, and are paying dividends. I think dividends are one thing that's been probably underestimated over the last cycle when everyone's been chasing growth, and in particular revenue growth. And historically, dividends have made up at least 50% of the ASX's long-term returns. And I think this might be a time to focus once again on dividends. High interest rates have also probably crowded out the attention to dividends. And when we're finding just stocks that generally have great cash flows and high dividends, if not super high growth, those are looking more attractive at the moment.
That's a really cool way of thinking about it. And I know for a lot of our investors, they just tend to look at banks for dividends. I was trying to think of a nicer way to put that, but basically they're just by banks. It's very interesting. I noticed you didn't mention CBA in your high quality, high price category. Thoughts on that one?
Yeah, CBA is I think it's a bit of a special case. For a long time, we've been negative on banks. And, you know, that's not an original statement. I think lots of people have been negative on banks for all the reasons we know. You know, there's less growth in banks now, and they are so dominated by mortgage lending. You know, more than half, about 60% of their lending books are dominated by mortgages. And when you break all the banks apart, and you look at the returns they make on a dollar of lending, those returns are about the same everywhere in the world, about 1%. Bank makes about 1% return on assets. That's true in Australia. It's true of all the big four banks. It's true of pretty much every big bank everywhere in the world. The reason Australian banks make higher returns on equity is because, unlike most banks who have maybe 20 or 30% of their lending pools in mortgages, Australian banks have 60, sometimes 70% of their lending pools in mortgages, and they can leverage those pools up much higher. So they only have to hold aside a small amount of money if they're lending against property. If they're lending to businesses, they have to hold aside more amounts of money. And so their returns on equity for Australian banks are much, much higher. They're leveraged about 10 to 1, whereas most international banks are not leveraged quite as much. You know, that doesn't make them riskier because they are lending against property, which is a very safe thing to do. But it does mean that the fate of the banks is tied so closely to the fate of the property market. And that doesn't just mean property prices going up and down. That means how much buying activity is happening in the property market. So what they do is really a function of what happens in that property market. So I don't have a strong view on it. I mean, we've been, I'd say, probably wrong about CBA for a long time. It is an extraordinary business that has performed extraordinarily well. It's way ahead of its competitors because it invests so much more of its revenue in technology. And you can probably see that as a customer. As I say this to you as a NAB employee, I just realized.
I am laughing back here.
Yeah. I don't have a strong view on banks. I will say if you're going to buy one, my preference would be for CBA simply because they are well ahead of the other banks in terms of their investing in technology. And I think that means the other banks probably have a lot of catch-up CapEx to make, a bit like Coles is really catching up in its CapEx against Woolies. Probably have an extra $1 billion to spend, whereas Woolies can now maybe not spend quite as much. I don't have an excellent answer for you there, except one that probably explains why we don't own any banks in our portfolios at all.
I think it's still a super interesting discussion because for so many of our investors, financials are where they plan to get their yield from. It's not necessarily where they get their yield from. So I was speaking with the journalist the other day and the query that was put to me was with BHP sort of cutting its dividend a little bit, where are investors going to get their dividends from? And I was like, God, I am old enough to remember that you never invest in commodities or resources for yield. Like,
that's
just the last thing you do. They don't pay you that kind of return. Your return comes from capital growth. It doesn't come in the form of income. That's just what commodities and resources are. Mm. So hilarious that there has been such a dramatic shift. Not in mentality. Like if your experience of investing is for the last 5 years, or I think you kind of sort of was closer to a decade really, and you held BHP in your portfolio, you would have seen that it was returning this fantastic yield for you, which is just not how those of us who've been around a little bit longer would imagine things would play out. But here we are. So if we exclude then the resources space more broadly and financials, which is more than 50% of the market, and it's definitely more than 50% of our holdings for our investors, you're down to, you've only stripped out, two sectors, but you're down to like 48% of the market, but much broader and more interesting category of companies, right? Like it's just much wider range of opportunities. Are there any specifics within that sector-wise that you really like, or just looking again for the quality?
Most investors probably emphasize the size of the yield too much. I would say the trajectory of the yield is more important. You're better off buying a lower yielding business that's growing its dividend rather than a company that's paying a obviously high yield. And an example of that is Lovisa, I'd say. Lovisa might not strike you as being a high dividend stock, and it pays a 3% yield or so, and it's, you know, obviously not as good as the CBA or another high yielding stock, but they are growing ferociously. Their store growth, I mean, a few years ago, they probably had, I think they had about 200, 300 stores. They now have more than 800 worldwide. I reckon and they're probably opening 150 to 200 every year. So in the next 4 or 5 years, they're probably going to double their store count. And each store they open generates a free cash flow within 12 months or so. So you look out 5 years and, you know, the amount of free cash flow coming for that business can potentially double. And I think what looks like to be a 3% yield now may well be a 6% plus yield in 5 years' time or so. Now, there's one that doesn't look like a yield stock, but may well end up yielding pretty decently. And it's not being, I mean, it is expensive, but it's growing so quickly, it's probably worth paying up for. The other area that won't be popular, Gemma, but these coal businesses, New Hope and Whitehaven, these things are paying stupendous yields, sustainably, fully franked. And I think coal markets have permanently changed. And I think sort of $100 a ton is the new floor rather than $40 or $50. And so these companies can continue paying out generous yields for years, maybe decades. And the prices might not be bid up because there are a lot of investors and a lot of funds who can't buy fossil fuel miners. But through the dividends and the franking, we can do very, very well out of those businesses. So if you're willing to, that's another area of opportunity, I think.
It's a really interesting one. I wouldn't mind coming back to Lovisa again. Maybe it comes back to the things you learn when things go wrong, that aggressive growth profile, particularly the international growth profile, opening new stores. A lot of our investors have been burnt by companies that have taken this approach. So yeah. I love that you talked about the free cash flow and how quickly they are getting to effective profitability with these new stores. Because I think for a lot of our investors, as soon as they hear aggressive store rollout, particularly internationally, they're like, oh, yeah. Nope, I've seen this before. I yes. don't want to be participating in this one. There'll be a short seller somewhere who does a research piece that destroys my holding.
Yep. That's a reaction born out of experience. That's a very sensible reaction. And I must admit, it was my first reaction as well. We first started looking at Lovisa when the stock price was about $3. My first reaction was, this thing is a fraud because the financial results were just too good. And I thought, there's no way a retailer can earn returns so high. But after spending a bit more time with it and then giving it a few more years to mature, I started to understand how they're able to generate those returns and was comfortable with it. And as they started rolling out overseas, my initial caution gave way to incredible excitement. Lovisa has been my personal largest holding for years. We own it in all our funds. I think most people on the team own Lovisa and have done it for years. And the reason the opportunity was available was because Australia has never seen a successful international rollout before, and a successful retail international rollout before. It's because there was so much skepticism around the rollout. And initially, that's probably the right reaction. But once you start seeing the numbers come in, I mean, Australia is now 20% of that business. 80% of Lovisa is now overseas. There's no doubt that they have a business model that is successful and is being replicated successfully around the world. I mean, I just think it's hard to run that argument anymore. The question is really now about price, not really about success. We are seeing the first international retail rollout before our very eyes, and it's working. And most investors have decided not to look at it. And I think that's really interesting. So the skepticism you spoke about, that was the reason why the opportunity existed. Now, it's expensive now. It's 30 times earnings, which is incredibly expensive. But the store openings are happening so quickly and the financial returns are so good. I think it's a business that can grow into its very high valuation really, really quickly. And I am still happy to hold it. I haven't sold a single share. I've held it since $2 something. I haven't sold a single share. I always say that Lovisa is the one stock I bought at $2 something and I bought at $20 something. You know, 10x the initial purchase price, I was still buying at $20 something. I think the potential remains really, really vast if you think about how many stores they could have. I think that you could put another zero behind that final store count.
I love that. We haven't had a good story like that in a long time. and you're right, the experience of investors in international rollouts has been so consistently negative. And even when it does succeed, think of things like Flight Center, for example, there's some pretty rough moments along the way where you think, oh no, this is going to be another one. There could be another one that doesn't make it. And you know, they might scrape through, but it's very cool to hear one that's doing so well and that you've been so confident in for such a long time. Gaurav, anything else you'd like to leave investors with at this point? Is there any kind of burning topic? We've covered so much. There's a lot of very cool ideas for people to take away. Anything else you'd like them to be thinking about?
I just want to highlight this idea that businesses are, they're not themes to trade and they're not numbers on a screen. Like they're real entities. And I really want to encourage everyone to think about them as real entities. And that means there are people behind these businesses running them. And I'm not suggesting that everyone go out and try and meet these managers or try and read their body language or try and interpret every word. But it's really important, I think, to get out to AGMs and listen to the people running these companies. Think about them as real businesses. Think about what problem they're solving in the world. How much value are they actually creating in the world? And who's benefiting from that value creation? Is it the insiders? Is it the board? Or is it shareholders? Is it customers? You know, think about that. You know, this AI boom we're going through, every business, you know, I think every business is going to have a really big AI component to it. You know, a lot of intelligent investor content in 10 years may be generated by AI, but I don't think that means we're going to be making, you know, as a business, a lot more money. It just means our prices will be lower and the consumers will benefit from that technology change. So you need to think about that as well. You know, the extra value that gets created, who captures that value? So I just want to encourage investors to think a bit more deeply about these businesses that they're investing in and what happens to the value that gets created, and to think about that value, you know, and not think about numbers on a screen or a theme or a name. And these are real entities, and it takes a lot of just thought to get to the bottom of them.
I love that. And there is so much individuals can do now to get access to, you know, insights about the company. So it actually leads beautifully to my next question, which is, where do people go to follow you and to keep up to date with what you and Intelligent Investor are doing? You put out some great research, and it's deep research. It's very well thought through and well articulated. Where do people go to find out more?
Yeah, it has to be deep research because we invest in ideas. My portfolio is made up of probably 80, 90% ideas that I've written about and published about. We have funds which obviously invest in all our best ideas as well. It's all available at intelligentinvestor.com.au. We don't really do Twitter or what's the other social media site, Gemma?
LinkedIn. LinkedIn's the more work one. I mean, you could do Instagram. You could have a go.
Yeah, I don't think we do. I'm certainly not on Instagram or Facebook or anything. The reason is I find the best way to make good decisions is not to be influenced by other people's ideas or opinions. And so I don't want to hear other people's ideas and opinions too much. It stops me, I'm able to control my sphere of influence that way. So I'm not on those social stuff, but Intelligent Investor is the best way to go to the website.
Your marketing people are going to hate you.
They're going to, they've been trying for years to get me on there. But I'm telling them, you can have good returns or you can have lots of us on social
media. Or I can be on the feed. One or the other, you choose. Yeah. Gaurav Sodhi from Intelligent Investor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you so much for listening. Also, as always, we love hearing from you. We love hearing which guests you'd like to hear from, the topics you want to hear about. We know you love Gaurav and you love hearing from him and the Intelligent Investor guys. Please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au and I look forward to talking to you again soon. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.